Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have with us today Marshall Bowen. Marshall, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks, Jody. I'm glad to be here.
Marshall is unique in that not only is he a proud St. Mary's Law grad like yours truly, we like to promote St. Mary's where we can, in addition to University of Houston, which is Jody's law school.
That's right. Go Cougars.
But Marshall is unique in that he has come off a succession of clerkships at the Court of Criminal Appeals here in Texas, and most recently the Supreme Court, clerking for our recent guest, Justice Paul Green. So Marshall brings some different viewpoints about clerkships, and now he's headed into private practice. Why don't you give us a little overview, Marshall, of your background to fill in the gaps for what I just said?
Yeah, of course. Well, thanks again for having me. I love listening to the podcast, and I'm grateful to get to spend some time with you all this morning. I grew up in Austin. I'm an Austin native, and I went to Texas A&M for undergrad and studied political science. And then after I graduated in 2012, I moved back to Austin, and I worked kind of in public affairs and for a small public affairs consulting firm here. And then I worked in the legislature for a member of the Texas House during the 84th session, and kind of thought I wanted to do kind of public policy work. But during that session, I kind of realized that I wanted to become an attorney. So I went to St. Mary's in the fall of 2015. My wife's from San Antonio. I was actually born in San Antonio, so it was a good fit. And then I started clerking for Judge Urie on the Court of Criminal Appeals after I graduated in 2018. I was with the Court of Criminal Appeals for the 2018 to 2019 term. And then I moved over and moved up one floor in the Supreme Court building to start working for Justice Green on the Supreme Court from 2019 to 2020. And then just a few weeks ago, I joined the appellate practice group, Butler Snow, here in Austin. And I'm really excited about being there.
Congratulations on that. We've had a couple of your coworkers on our podcast in earlier episodes.
Yeah, I was just listening to those the other day.
Yeah, Amanda Taylor and Scott Field are friends of ours and friends of the show. And certainly they've got a good thing going on over there at Butler Snow. And I think you'll enjoy working with them. That'll be a good setup for you.
I'm grateful to be working with two incredible appellate lawyers there. So
I know you worked at the legislature and kind of got firsthand experience of how the sausage is made over there at the Capitol. What made you decide after law school that you wanted to go the clerkship route?
Yeah, so I've always been kind of interested in our state government, working in the legislature. Of course, I worked on drafting legislation, but the judiciary was kind of a place I'd never really worked, of course, because I hadn't gone to law school. And I think probably the impetus for my interest in clerking came from my dad's experience as a law clerk. He clerked for Judge Raul Gonzalez, who Todd clerked for during the 1991 to 1992 term. And he told me just what an incredible experience that was. And so I kind of had that seed planted in my head as I went to law school. And then once I started law school, I started interning in the chambers of a few federal judges. And I kind of realized this is work I would really enjoy doing. And I saw the value that it would add to my career immediately after I finished. So I pretty much set my sights from my first day at St. Mary's that I wanted to clerk somewhere. And so I just tried to do all the things along the way, get good grades, do the law journal, kind of the typical boxes you need to check to put yourself in a position to clerk.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Do you have advice for law students who might be thinking about clerkships, things they can do, ways that they can position themselves, or steps that you took that you think are helpful? I mean, I know you mentioned a couple. I don't know if there's anything else.
Yeah. First, just as a preliminary matter, I think I would recommend clerking to pretty much anybody. I don't think there's a better bang for your buck in terms of time you can spend right out of law school to get experience to become an attorney. I mean, I'm speaking from just my brief time as an attorney so far, practicing attorney, but I think the insight you get into the judiciary, the way you get to see how judges develop their judicial philosophy, the way you see a vast array of briefing strategies, I think that experience enables you to add value immediately to your clients when you get into practice and to the partners you're working for. But I think along the way, of course, doing well in your classes is the first step. Earning high grades is an important criteria. Being on Law Journal is a very important piece of a clerkship application. But then also developing strong relationships with professors who can write, and preferably professors who have also clerked, who can kind of write letters on your behalf to the judges you're applying to. And then just being on top of the deadlines. Increasingly now, clerkship deadlines start popping a couple of years in advance of the opening. So you really need to be mindful of the deadlines and get your applications in quickly because they're increasingly competitive.
This is happening mostly in the 2L year now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think fall of your 2L year is really when you need to start because you have a full year of grades at that point. So you have something to kind of stand on. And that's usually when judges start to hire.
Is Vincent Johnson still the clerkship advisor at St. Mary's?
As far as I know, that's who I went to for kind of all my clerkship questions. And he was extremely helpful in kind of guiding me through. So if you're a St. Mary's student, be sure to talk to Professor Johnson.
Well, and he's who I talked to way back in the day. It's funny because I noticed within the last couple of years that St. Mary's had really done a good job of trying to market its students for clerkships. They put out a brochure with photos, and I kind of laughed at the time because it, you know, basically in my day in the 90s, it was me going to Professor Johnson's office saying, "Hey, yeah, I kind of am interested in this clerkship thing. What should I do?" And he gave me some tips and I went from there, but I didn't have any glossy brochure to help market St. Mary's as a good source of clerkships. Although, you know, over the years, I'll say there have been a number of St. Mary's grads who have clerked in very important positions, including as you have in the Supreme Court, as I did. So there's a good track record over the years, I would say, of placing clerks.
Yeah, I think the more that folks like me and you, Todd, who went to go back to our alma maters and say, we clerked and this is kind of how it helped me get ahead in my career trajectory, is really beneficial to show students the value. Because I think a lot of times law students think I need to get out and start practicing and making money. But I think that 1 year, if you can do it, is definitely worth delaying that start.
Did you apply outside of the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Supreme Court? Did you look at federal clerkships, for example?
I did. I applied to federal clerkships as well. And I got one interview in a federal clerkship, but those are really competitive because folks compete all across the country for a very limited number of spots. So I kind of was a little more targeted in knowing that I wanted to clerk, be in Texas, and wanted to practice in Texas long term. So I really sought out Judge Urey because I respect him a lot as a judge and as a person, and really wanted to work under him. And the same thing for Justice Green. So on those two courts, I was really seeking out those individual judges, but I did put out a wide net.
And Judge Urey, being yet another St. Mary's law grad, the network does take care of itself, I will say. And Judge Green was a big supporter of hiring clerks from St. Mary's. So those connections don't hurt.
Yeah, definitely do target those judges who are graduates from your law school, because your application will definitely, I think, stand out across those judges' desks.
Had you done much or had a lot of experience thinking about wanting to do criminal law when you went to the Court of Criminal Appeals, or was it more you're interested in working for Judge Urey?
Yeah, so I applied for that clerkship during my 2L year, and I was kind of up in the air at that point. I wasn't sure exactly where I wanted to practice. You know, I thought about going into the public service. And so I was kind of open, genuinely, and curious about what I enjoyed doing criminal law. And so I thought it was a good fit to see the inside of that world, clerking for Judge Urey. But then I wasn't sure. So I figured, well, maybe I should just apply to the Supreme Court too for the next year and just kind of give myself a full kind of mini master's degree in Texas law. It's a 2-year program. And so that was kind of how I came to deciding to apply to both courts, was really with an open mind of where I wanted to practice. But I did feel at that point that I wanted to go into appellate law. I loved written advocacy. I loved writing. I loved the research. I kind of began to feel a draw to wanting to do appellate law. And so I knew wherever I ended up, clerkships at high appellate courts would be beneficial.
So can you describe for us kind of what the Court of Criminal Appeals experience was like? Todd and I think we're talking before the show, neither one of us really knows a lot of workings of that court.
Yeah. So I took on a little fascination with our unique system in Texas as after clerking there. You know, as far as I can tell, there haven't been too many people that have chosen to clerk at both high courts. Wayne Scott, who's a professor at St. Mary's, did it back in the 60s. But since the Court of Criminal Appeals received discretionary review authority in 1980, I don't know. I've asked around to the clerks of the court and no one really knows. So if there's other folks out there, I'd love to chat with them, but I've never met anyone else who chose to do this. But Texas is the only state in the country with two true high courts. Oklahoma has a Court of Criminal Appeals. It has exclusive criminal jurisdiction, but the Supreme Court of Oklahoma can decide conflicts of jurisdiction between the two courts. We don't have a provision like that in our Constitution. So, and also the Oklahoma Constitution allows the legislature to change the jurisdiction of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Our Constitution has separate sections delegating the jurisdiction to the Supreme Court and to the Court of Criminal Appeals. So while they have a high criminal court, it's not an entirely standalone court of last resort, a resort that's constitutionally mandated like the Court of Criminal Appeals. So, you know, the Court of Criminal Appeals came to be because of just a caseload overload on the Supreme Court in 1876. And so they created the Court of Appeals, and then that helped alleviate the burden from the Supreme Court. And then over the years, that kind of morphed into constitutional amendments into the Court of Criminal Appeals when they gave the courts of appeals criminal jurisdiction. And then, of course, they created discretionary review authority for the Court of Criminal Appeals. So it's kind of been this evolution of docket management, I think, is probably a large piece of it. And as you all talked about on the show before, there's a great benefit to this because the Supreme Court gets to focus on civil matters and the Court of Criminal Appeals gets to focus on criminal matters. And so you create an appellate practice that's unique before the two courts. So the Court of Criminal Appeals is still extremely busy. You know, they handle thousands of writs of habeas corpus. They're the final fact finder in the writs of habeas corpus. They have discretionary review, of course, under petitions for discretionary review is what they're called at that court. So PDRs, not PFRs. And then they have direct appeals on death penalty cases. So capital cases skip the intermediate courts of appeals and go straight to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And those have to be reviewed. So the jurisdiction's a little different, but in terms of kind of the posture, it's very similar. It's a lot of reviewing petitions and deciding whether to grant. But the writ workload makes the Court of Criminal Appeals really unique, just because you have thousands and thousands of writs of habeas corpus and mandamus that are filed that have to be disposed of. And that takes up a lot of the court's time.
Those capital cases also have unique word count limits or page limits, as I recall, just from seeing that in the appellate rules. I would imagine that those are very serious matters when they come in and often involve, you know, lengthy, detailed briefs that the court and the clerks have to pour through.
Yeah, and that raises a good point, Todd, about the difference between the workload at the two courts. So at the Court of Criminal Appeals, each judge has one law clerk, one staff attorney, and an executive assistant. At the Supreme Court, each justice has two law clerks, a staff attorney, and an executive assistant. So you have one less law clerk in each chambers at the Court of Criminal Appeals. And that's because they have a big office of central staff lawyers, maybe 18, 19 lawyers, who are divided up into three divisions: capital cases, the petitions for discretionary review, and the writs of habeas corpus. And those staff lawyers kind of do the initial intake of cases and do kind of summaries of the cases for the chambers. So the CCA kind of puts a lot of the work into the central staff of lawyers, whereas at the Supreme Court, a lot of that work's handled by the chambers because we have just a small central staff lawyer, just a general counsel and a rules attorney, a mandamus attorney. So the workload is divided a little bit differently between the two courts.
How many cases? I know the Supreme Court takes 80 to 100-ish cases a year. How many cases does the CCA take for oral argument in any given year? Do you know?
That's another interesting point, Jody, is for oral argument, the Court of Criminal Appeals hears a lot less cases. Pretty much the Supreme Court grants oral argument in most cases that are granted, not in per curiams, but in signed opinions. The Supreme Court pretty much grants oral argument in all those cases, you all know. But in the Court of Criminal Appeals, they'll grant lots of petitions and deny oral argument, or the parties won't ask for it, or they won't grant it. But it's the percentage of grants, from my recollection, is similar between the two courts, but the oral argument percentage is a lot lower at the Court of Criminal Appeals. Sure. So you don't have, like, in the term, argument sittings almost 3 weeks a month or something like you would at the Supreme Court.
Do the clerks still get to participate in the conferences at the CCA like you do at Supreme Court?
We don't. And so that's another really unique experience at the Supreme Court, is that all the law clerks get to sit in the conference room during conference. And that's an incredible experience, because you really just get to sit there and literally be a fly on the wall and watch the judges get into, until they call on you and say, "Oh, Marshall, you know, what do you think about this memo you wrote?" And then you have to stand up before all nine justices and hope you can field the questions they ask. But that was the coolest part, I think, about the clerkship at the Supreme Court, because at the CCA, it's just the judges in the conference. So you're kind of waiting there to see when your judge comes back and say, you know, "So what happened in conference?" And you kind of have to frantically write down everything he says.
It's like your first experience in advocating before the Supreme Court is sitting in conference and being called on, almost like law school.
Yeah. That's what I was just thinking.
You don't know when that's going to happen. And so that is a tremendous experience. And as I understand it, I think the Supreme Court is the only court in the country that allows that.
Yeah, I think we were for a long time. I think I heard that Kentucky has since followed us and changed their model to allow law clerks. I heard that. So I don't know if anyone else has, but certainly in terms of a Texas clerking experience, it's the only way to get in the room.
You mentioned in the habeas petitions that the court is the final fact finder. So is there actually a fact finding role even though it's an appellate court there?
Yeah, it's kind of unique. So when a writ of habeas corpus is filed in the convicting court, as we call it, so that was the court that oversaw the conviction, there's a timeline for the clerk of that court to automatically forward the petition to the Court of Criminal Appeals, no matter what's happened in the case. So the convicting court can hold hearings to gather evidence. They can take affidavits. They can do all sorts. They can pretty much use any discovery mechanism to build a record, a habeas record. But even if they're not done with it yet, the petition gets forwarded to the Court of Criminal Appeals. I think it's like, I used to know, I think 145 days or 90 days or some time limit when it gets forwarded. And so it could have been forwarded to the Court of Criminal Appeals in the middle of a fact-finding expedition. And so the Court of Criminal Appeals often will remand that case back to the convicting court to finish the fact-finding. Or sometimes the convicting court doesn't do anything and it just gets forwarded. And so the Court of Criminal Appeals will send it back to develop more facts for the habeas record. But ultimately, oftentimes the convicting court will make a recommendation whether to grant or deny habeas relief. And that recommendation comes up to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Well, the Court of Criminal Appeals can look at the record and make their own determination and reject the recommendation of the convicting court and enter their own findings. So it is kind of unique that this high appellate court is the final fact finder in writs of habeas corpus. So, you know, a lot of times the court will follow the recommendation of the convicting court, but sometimes the court will enter its own decision and reject the recommendation of the convicting court.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very fascinating kind of appellate posture.
Well, habeas corpus is its own animal. I mean, we see the writ of habeas corpus on the civil side pretty infrequently. On the criminal side, it's almost, I suppose it is sort of its own subspecialty. Because I see criminal lawyers who really focus their practices on that, and yet they are in the appellate courts not only in the state system, but of course in the federal system too. Because as I recall from my law school days, that system is really long and windy.
Yeah.
And can go from state to federal and then go up from there.
Yeah, it bounces back and forth between the whole federal writ process and the state writ process. But you're right, Todd, that you can gain this experience and a real specialty in doing criminal writ work. And as a clerk on the Court of Criminal Appeals, you get exposed to that process in incredible detail. And so you become very familiar with how it all works and the different arguments that are made and the case law surrounding code of criminal procedures. So it's, if you have any interest at all in doing that kind of work, a clerkship at the Court of Criminal Appeals is the best place to go.
And the Board of Legal Specialization within the last 5 years or so has started offering a specialization in criminal appellate law. So my next question, aside from that commentary, was just in your time at the Court of Criminal Appeals, did you see advocates come in who had that specialization? Were there the kinds of specialists practicing in that area, like what you now see at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't know if I noticed if any, I'm sure I did, because we had lots of advocates who are very specialized in the criminal appellate process and who appeared frequently before the court and were very involved in high profile cases. So I'm sure I saw some that had that designation, but you definitely start to see the same, like you do it in civil appellate law, you see kind of the same advocates in a lot of cases who have created a specialty in kind of complex criminal appellate litigation.
So after you had your year at the CCA, you moved, I guess, upstairs or kind of across the hall to the Supreme Court. How was the transition? What was the experience like kind of going over to the civil side of the docket?
Yeah, fortunately, because I was just moving in the building, it was a really smooth transition. All of the folks in the clerk's offices kind of know each other. So it was everyone was a little taken back. They're like, so you're going to go to civil law now? Because I think a lot of times folks that love criminal law are like, why would you go do civil law? You know, this is so much more interesting practice. So I moved over to civil law and into the Supreme Court. And, you know, pretty much, like I said at the beginning, it was a similar posture, you know, kind of reviewing decisions of the courts of appeals, reading briefs. And so the biggest difference was the variety of law you see, of course, at the Supreme Court, right? You can be hopping from a property law issue to a contract issue to a tort issue, kind of all throughout the day. Whereas in the Court of Criminal Appeals, while there are tons of different crimes and different laws surrounding those, the posture is always kind of the same. It's the government versus an individual. So you start to kind of see themes emerge in kind of criminal law jurisprudence in Texas. But in the civil law context, it's kind of all over the map. So I think that was the biggest adjustment, was just kind of having to dive into new areas of the law as you read new briefs. But I think I was well prepared for drafting opinions and for reading briefs because I had just done that for a year with Judge Erie.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
What you just described is basically the same experience that every civil appellate lawyer goes through on a regular basis, unless you have a super specialized, you know, like tort practice or something. It's one of the things that's so great about it, and that I always shout praises for, is just the ability to be involved in so many different areas of the law that are interesting. And some might say that that's a bit of a disadvantage because it's hard to develop a real specialty in the substantive law. But one thing that we've done, all of us who've gone through this and become appellate lawyers, civil appellate lawyers, is we know how to learn and we know how to teach ourselves the law and usually how to write. And most of us do, I think. So the skill set applies seemingly across the board. But I think it's funny what you said about being involved in so many different areas of the law, just because that's been my experience throughout my career as a civil appellate lawyer.
Mine too. You kind of become a little mini expert in a silo of some specific topic that you never would have thought, hey, I want to learn about this. And then a couple months later, you jump over and you become a mini expert in some totally new random area of the law that you thought, hey, I never would have thought about learning this. It really is kind of fun to dive in and do a real deep dive on something that you never would have thought you'd learn about.
My favorite way to express it is that I practice bathtub law, which is I fill the bathtub up learning about a substantive area. And then when I finish that project, I pull the plug and drain it and fill it up again.
I like that analogy. I think that's pretty apt. I think that's very similar to my experience. And then sometimes you start to see patterns that come through in different types of cases and different issues. It is. It's really interesting and satisfying, I think, to be able to do it that way. Our expertise really is in the process and the presentation and the advocacy, not so much the substance.
Right.
I think that's what drew me to Pellet Law to begin with, was just kind of an interest in a variety of practice areas and not being kind of confined to one type of case, but getting to see kind of a bunch of different areas of the law, but doing it all kind of in the written advocacy context with what drew me into appellate law to begin with.
We've had a lot of guests on here that have clerked at the Supreme Court, but I don't know that anybody has really talked about sort of what clerks do at the Supreme Court day to day. Can you kind of talk about what a clerk's role is in the various chambers?
Yeah, of course. So I would kind of break the clerk's role into three categories. One is drafting memos, primarily study memos, which you probably remember from your time, which are kind of summaries of the case and analysis of the brief and a recommendation to the court about that petition. And so that's kind of the primary role is the study memo drafting, because that's only done by law clerks. And then within that are other memos that you are asked to draft for the court or for your judge, kind of internal memos about pending cases or kind of whatever issue the court or your judge would like a memo about. You're kind of responsible for that. And then the second bucket is drafting opinions, which was my favorite part about clerking for sure. And that just involves working with your judge to come up with how the case should be decided. And then depending on how the judge and the chambers operate, taking the first step at drafting the opinion. And that to me was the most fun experience, because you get to be creative in your writing. You get to kind of shape the case. You get to put pen to paper on how we're going to actually resolve this usually very difficult dispute. And that's a huge learning experience and understanding the law surrounding the issue, the parties' arguments, what happened at the Court of Appeals. So that's a big responsibility. And then that also includes drafting dissenting opinions and concurrences, which are also very fun to draft, of course, because you get to be a little more free in those than you do when you're drafting a majority opinion. And then the last thing is kind of just administrative work around the court, primarily oral argument assistance. So we kind of serve as the marshals, no pun intended with my name. But we kind of coordinate the oral argument on the morning of the argument. So we sit in the courtroom, as y'all know, the two folks sitting at the desk are law clerks, and that just alternates each week on who's up to do that. And so that's a very like intimidating part of the job. Your first time, you have to announce the party's names and make sure you don't misstate someone's name or say it at the right time. So that's a fun part of the job too. But so it's kind of administrative, drafting opinions and writing memos.
Yeah. So not only do you get to present to the Supreme Court in the confines of the conference room, you get to actually speak out loud in the courtroom to set up an oral argument. And you left off the most important thing. You got to learn how to pronounce Oye appropriately. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. It's not Oye or
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh yes. Oh yes. Oh yes.
I was a pro by the time I got there, because I'd been saying Oh yes at the Court of Criminal Appeals for a year. So I was training all my new clerks about the proper enunciation of Oh yes.
Yeah. Nice. I was just going to say, I always thought marshaling was one of the more fun parts, because that's really, you know, that's the closest you get to real world practice aside from conference room experience. I mean, observing appellate lawyers who are there to present their cases to the court and being part of that is just very special.
Yeah, it was neat to have a literally front row seat to appellate advocacy right there in the courtroom.
And you get to see some of the best of the best in there too, which is fun. You sort of got the unique and maybe unenviable experience of living through COVID and ransomware while you were clerking, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
How was that? Especially having had a full regular clerkship to have yours sort of derailed 2/3 of the way through.
Yeah, you know, I think the most frustrating part about it was just the lack of kind of camaraderie with my co-clerks at the court. One of the biggest benefits of clerking, in my opinion, at the Supreme Court especially, is this unique community you're thrust into of all newly licensed or newly graduated attorneys, law students who are entering into this kind of special place for 1 year when everyone's on the same level. There's no competition for trying to get ahead. You're all doing the same thing. It's a sprint because you're just there for a year. and you're all kind of excited because you're just out of law school. So it creates this like kind of perfect community, I think. And so the biggest bummer was just not having that for the second half of our clerkship. And I was really sad because we had kind of built this strong bond, the 18 of us. And so we kind of had to resort to doing Zoom happy hours and try to stay in touch. But I hope to keep our class together in some connection throughout our careers, because I think it'll be a valuable network down the road.
Absolutely.
Well, I can say that it is. I remain very good friends with some folks that I clerked with. And yeah, we do have the Supreme Court. I don't know how it is on the Court of Criminal Appeals, but the Supreme Court really does sort of treat everyone like family. And once you're in the family, you know, you're in. There's kind of like the mafia. You can never leave. But from a way more positive perspective, yeah, I can only imagine the way it must have been from March forward. You know, that it didn't exactly get to wind up on a note that you would have liked to, but I'm certainly happy. It's very interesting the way the timing worked out with Justice Green deciding to retire. I guess he'd had enough of his clerks and decided it was time to ride off into the sunset.
Yeah, I guess we just pushed him out. I was joking. I just barely beat him out the door finishing up my clerkship on August 21st. But I was grateful. I told him this, I didn't know this, of course, when I was hired, and he probably didn't either, that I would be one of his last two clerks. And I was just so grateful because I really wanted to clerk for Justice Green. And so I was so grateful to get to slide in there right under the wire. But I think also back on this interesting time, I'll commend the court because we cleared our docket on time. And as you all know, and did really good work throughout the ransomware and the virus. And so I think it's just a testament to the people that work at the court, especially the clerk's office and the staff, that we really were able to have a successful year. But it's difficult to be just kind of at home alone working on memos and opinions and not being able to walk down the hall and talk to your co-clerk about this case. So that was a little difficult.
Absolutely.
How did the court handle communications with staff over that time? I mean, I know generally how they communicate with each other, but that's a whole different dynamic. I mean, Judge Green having to communicate with you or your co-clerk or the staff attorney or his EA about just day-to-day stuff. I mean, the court set up a system that allowed y'all to have like a private chat, or were you texting, or how did it go?
Yeah, so we each had like, you know, a chamber Zoom account, of course. And so we could do that. But Justice Green is an incredibly responsive judge. You know, he was always on top of everything. And so I could email him something and I would get a response almost immediately. So he was very responsive to us especially during that time. And so I think for our chambers, we just could pick up the phone and call Judge whenever we had a question. He would answer, call us back immediately. So the court did give us Zoom and we had Microsoft Teams, which is kind of like y'all probably familiar with Microsoft Teams. So I think the clerks utilized that more to kind of talk among each other. But in terms of our chambers, Justice Green was, even before this pandemic hit, he was really great about having very clear lines of communication with him. So I think the key was just to be able to pick up the phone and call your judge, because you can't walk into his office or wait to grab him when he comes back from argument. You know, you kind of, all those like kind of natural situations that you have at the court are gone. So you have to feel comfortable. And Justice Green did this, and I assume every judge did this, but to be saying, hey, just call me when you need to talk about this. But it was difficult because even a phone call isn't as helpful as kind of sitting next to someone and talking to them.
Absolutely.
Well, and maybe the most important question, were you able to go flying with him before COVID shut everything down?
No, I wasn't. And I'm hopeful I will get to, because my in-laws live in San Antonio, we go down there a lot. So I'm going to keep bugging him to pick me up in the plane one day.
Sounds like it won't be too hard to twist.
Yeah, he loves it. And it's fun to hear about all of his adventures where he's flown all over the country.
He told us a story about taking Judge Brown and Judge Boyd to an oral argument. I think he said it was in Huntsville.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what the cockpit must have been like for that trip with those three.
No kidding.
So now you're in private practice, and I know you're brand new in your firm.
3 weeks.
Yeah. Gosh, how's that been, getting hired on and brought into a firm during the pandemic time?
Yeah. You know, I was really grateful to Butler Snow. It's been a difficult landscape out there for a lot of firms navigating the pandemic. And Butler Snow maintained really great communication with us about our start date and about all the information. So I felt good about where I was starting in the midst of all of this. But it was a lot of, you know, Zoom orientation, talking to lawyers from our offices around the country and meeting the different practice group leaders versus in Zoom. But it's been great working with Amanda and Scott, because as you all know them well, are just great people and great mentors. And so they've been able to help me get acclimated to how we work. And I do go into the office sometimes. We can kind of go in as we want. So I have made my office kind of my home, which is nice. After being in here for so long, it's kind of nice to have a new venue. But I'm just kind of jumping right into it. I'm really grateful to be working with them. And so far, like I said, it's only been 3 weeks, but I really am enjoying the work.
One of the partners there, Eric Nichols, I believe, has a lot of criminal law experience. And so I wonder if Eric is going to be knocking on your door before too long.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I told him I'd be happy to help out with some criminal law. So I don't want to miss out on kind of leveraging my experience from the Court of Criminal Appeals to the future. And I've talked to Scott and Amanda too. You know, I think I'd enjoy still doing some criminal appellate work if those kinds of opportunities presented themselves, because I did really enjoy that subject matter of the law. It's kind of 1L law type stuff, right? It's Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment a lot of times. So it's a fun area of the law to get to litigate. And so I would love to, if it was possible, still do some criminal appellate work.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, I mean, I know you're only 3 weeks in, but do you feel the benefits of the clerkships that you did now that you're in as a practicing lawyer? Do you think that's helped you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the biggest benefits are you understand kind of the internal process of the court and how things move through the court, and also what judges are interested in briefs and what kind of piques their interest. And also understanding your audience, I think, is really important, that a lot of times your audience, when you're drafting a brief, is a law clerk. And who's really going to dig into the brief is going to be the law clerk. And so I think having come from just reading a bunch of briefs and knowing that was helpful when the advocate did this in a brief, or this was not helpful, or this was confusing, kind of coming off of reading all those briefs to now beginning to work on briefs, I think it's an incredibly helpful background. But it's also kind of eye-opening, like, you know, you see things like a notice of appeal when you're at the court, but then when you have to file a notice of appeal, you're like, I don't really know. Amanda, how do you file a notice of appeal? So I think it's fun how these things you just kind of see on the screen, how they actually come to real life in the practice.
I think all of this talking to you is a good reminder, anybody who's a law student, that I feel like a lot of times law schools really stress federal clerkships as sort of the holy grail, but there's a whole world of state clerkships that bring you in contact with a lot of really interesting stuff and really practical experience, because that's where most of the litigation happens, frankly.
I agree. And I think, you know, certainly clerking at a federal court's a great experience, but if you have an interest in being a Texas trial or appellate lawyer, clerking at the Supreme Court might be the best place for you to go, because you become familiar with the kind of contours of the law on different issues. You understand the judicial philosophy of the court. You understand kind of what kind of cases are likely to end up in the court. You understand how to avoid problems in the trial court that often appear on appeal. So I think all those things are beneficial to you if you're going to be a Texas litigator. And the Texas Supreme Court might be the best in terms of a practical experience for you aboard a clerk.
You described your clerkship experience as sort of almost like an extension of law school. And that was the way that I viewed it. And I think what you said about the Supreme Court clerkship for a Texas appellate lawyer is exactly right. That's been my experience for, gosh, you know, more years than I care to think of now. And I do lament, though, that the intermediate courts have kind of moved away from a clerkship model into a permanent staff model. I think it's great for folks to be able to have those permanent staff jobs and really become sort of court specialists like they have in the federal system, you know, as like a career clerk. But unfortunately, that's turned up the competition, I think, for the Supreme Court and Court of Criminal Appeals clerkships. And as a result, there just are fewer people that are able to take advantage of that experience at the intermediate court level, which I think had a tremendous amount of value too.
Yeah, I guess I can understand why they did away with it to some degree, because you have to go through that hiring every year, and those courts are, you know, extremely busy and kind of have year-round dockets. But it is a bummer, because I think the more people that can clerk, I think the better the practice of law will be ultimately. If you can have more folks that have filtered through that system to see how it's kind of done, then hopefully you have attorneys that are coming out ready to practice right away in a meaningful way. But there's no, clerking is not at all a requirement, and there's plenty of lawyers who don't clerk. But it's, but for me, I just thought that from what I was interested in, and I kind of enjoyed the intellectual experience of studying the law, that clerking was a, if you don't really want to dig in and do a bunch of writing, a bunch of research, then clerking is definitely not for you. If you want to.
Neither is appellate work for that matter.
Yeah, for that matter, you're probably not listening to this podcast. But if that's of interest to you, then clerking for sure would be a good fit.
Well, we've kind of come to the end of the time that we usually reserve. So, and I think we've certainly covered the waterfront, but we always like to ask our guests if they've got a tip or a war story to sort of leave as a parting thought for our guests. And I think we are today speaking significantly to law students who are considering clerkships. And so I don't want to limit you, Marshall, but do you have anything that we haven't covered that you would like to throw out there as being something for these people to consider?
I'll just add that I think as a law student, I got a call from a St. Mary's law student yesterday just asking me kind of what steps he should be. He's a first year. Should he be taking as he kind of thinks about his future? And I think that's really a good idea for young law students, even your first year, to try to find people that have done what you are interested in doing, and just preferably who went to your law school, and just reach out to them and don't be afraid to have those kinds of conversations. I did that a lot when I was a 1L, and I reached out to folks and said, hey, I'm kind of interested in doing what you did. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got there? And I think almost always people will be willing to have those conversations. So aside from the things we talked about earlier, like getting good grades and trying to do the law journal and kind of the obvious boxes, find people who are a little bit ahead of you in what you're doing and just reach out to them and say, hey, can I pick your brain about what you did? So I think that's probably the biggest piece of advice I have for law students as they kind of navigate the decision to clerk and how to kind of put themselves in a position to do that starting from your first day at law school.
So call Marshall. He's got lots of tips for you.
Yeah, I am always happy to chat. I love helping younger students. And I went to law school a little bit later, like I shared. I'm 30 now, so I'm not old, but
you know, not old.
No.
I felt like that there were a lot of students who were younger than me when I was in law school. Mm-hmm. Because if you went straight through college to law school, I was a few years older. So mm-hmm. I'm always happy to kind of chat about those decisions with anyone.
Well, thanks for spending the time with us today, Marshall. It's extremely valuable and I think it's a great overview. Really appreciate the compare and contrast between the CCA and the Supreme Court and speaking to clerkships and how valuable they are. Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really enjoyed spending some time with y'all, and I hope to see y'all in person sometime soon.
One day, we hope. Sooner rather than later, maybe.
I hope so. Absolutely.
Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram at TexAppLawPod, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Till next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TexAppLawPod.com or on Twitter @TexAppLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.